I think we all know why we're here.
Glad to see you all here. My usual method of operation is I'll start off with a brief statement. I'm told the briefer the better is the rule. To hear a lot of me is to want to hear a little of me after a while. And now the best part is taking questions from you guys. And this gentleman will be of assistance to you by bringing the microphone to you or having you line up or maybe a rectal examination or something or other.
It's okay. I'm a doctor.
So, and my feeling is only get the pertinent information is by asking impertinent questions, so feel free to ask impertinent questions. I gotta tell you, I worked in Canada for 2 years on Jeremiah, a show we did for Showtime. And, thank you. It's not a one fan clapping. And I was always hard pressed to find things to talk about across the cultural boundary between U.S. and Canada. And I was on the set on the location one night late at night, like two in the morning, I'm shooting late nights. What can I do to get the crew revved up? Hockey. I will take the position that hockey is not a sport. It's a game, not a sport. You know, there's a thing you can have a tie. In a sport, you can't have a tie. And so we waited around. Then eventually the conversation turned to hockey, big surprise. And I said, well, you know, hockey isn't really a sport. And imagine a shockwave spreading out. You can just see it go from person to person in a circle going out. And then, boom, hockey isn't a sport. And they got the exercise. We got actors sitting going, come on, guys. They were talking about why hockey isn't a sport. And I kept this on for like 2 weeks and just drove them nuts. And flash forward is 3 years later. All right, 3 years. And I'm seeing a friend at the set of Global Frequency where they're shooting the pilot. And they introduced me to the various personnel, including the DP, director of photography. And he says, what's your name again? And I said, Joe Straczynski. He said, I know you. You're the American who just said the hockey wasn't a sport. It is spread throughout Vancouver, apparently. So just to bring up the speed of where things are currently, I'm writing the Brave and the Bold now for DC, which is going really well. I'm very happy with that. Basically more on moral questions and things you wouldn't normally expect to see happen. Also, your Superman project for DC, I can't talk about yet in detail, but down the road, though, we'll talk about it some more. Finished up on 4. That's all nice and done now. Finishing up on 12. Finally. And in the film television area, I'm doing a pilot deal for Imagine Television, which we're taking out to the networks next week. Doing the next draft on Forbidden Planet. Doing the next draft on Lensman for Ron Howard. My film Ninja Assassin comes out November. Some of you may have seen the trailer for it already. Sound half a fan clapping. Just turned a script called Proving Ground to MGM. There's a script that I can't talk about. It's off the director's now. We hope to get a go ahead on it very soon. And I just been offered I'm being offered directing deals now, which is also kind of cool. And I don't want to be a director full time because it means getting up in the morning. And I don't like that. I'm looking forward to doing the occasional directing gig here and there. So we'll talk about that more today. So you guys, whatever questions you have, I'm here, I'm at your service, I am thus beneath thy feet.
Follow this man. Come on up here and we can
get
the line going a little bit.
All right.
Just a little. You know, just so everyone can hear, so first question, set the tone.
Hi, Joe. Welcome back to Toronto.
Thank you.
How are you feeling?
Mm-hmm. I'm okay. I still have a bit of a cough hanging on.
Thank you. Your background, we met at this convention 4 years ago. I asked you a question.
You were the guy with the hand on my knee.
I wasn't happy with the question I asked, but anyways.
You didn't deny it, I noticed.
Yeah. So basically, I came up with 2 questions this time, and I'm pretty sure they're pretty good ones. The first one, it comes to comics. Since these 4 years passed, we've had really nice transitions to movies. Like, I really like Iron Man franchise. I really love Hellboy. Out of the comic universes, which one would you like to be involved in translating into movie? That's my first question. I can ask a second one or wait?
Ask the second one.
Second one is a small show, just ended on a sci-fi called Battlestar Galactica. And the authors from the beginning mentioned that they're going to have a story arc, beginning, ending. I was like, where did that come? Found this one. And your thoughts as a producer on that show, and what you like, and you know, comments from you really mean to me a lot. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, I know Ron Moore and the guys on Battlestar, and they definitely were looking at Babylon 5 as a model for that, as were the guys on Lost. In fact, I know Damon Lindelof, who worked on Lost for some time, and they said the same thing. They were looking to create a five-year arc based on what Babylon 5 did, which is, I think, is terrific. To see shows take that tool and move on with it and create new stuff, that's what you want. You want to say, I carried the ball this far, you carry it the rest of the way. And let me see where you go and what you do with it. That's the fun of it to me. As to which character I love to do a film based on, there's no contest, no question, Superman. I mean, that's my guy. Yeah. When I was in Chicago for a Comic-Con there, some of you may know the story, I was in a dealer's room, like the ones they have here, the really long throws down the lane. And I hear a guy yelling, stop him, and some guy racing down the lane, a shoplifter grabs some stuff, and like the Red Sea, they parted, you know? And I just went for him, like a gazelle, I brought him right down. And we're holding him for the cops to show up, being the guy whose booth was robbed. And the Comic-Con organizer comes over and says to the guy in the floor, the guy named Babylon 5 just captured you, like, fuck you. And afterward, the con organizer said, why did you do this? I mean, you could have been hurt. I said, look where I was standing. And I was standing by a booth with a 10-foot tall cutout of Superman. How can you stand in front of that and do nothing? You know, you got to. I said, the Superman's my guy. That's what I would do for a film. I'd love to. Congratulations.
Spider-Man? Could have been Spider-Man.
But not
then,
the same.
And if you didn't stop him, he would have killed you.
Yeah, but I would have to try to web him. I have to use phlegm, and that wouldn't be terribly happy.
Fair enough.
Adrian, how you doing?
Peachy fucking keen, how are you?
Pretty much about the same. I just want to say
I'm so sorry.
I just want to say thank you for bringing me back into Spider-Man comics. Years ago, when you first started, I was in high school. I kept trying to get back in. Nothing happened. You came on. I was with your run the whole time you were on there, and then when it stopped, and I think we all know the story about that, I'm not getting into that, but when that stopped, I was kind of disappointed. And then to me personally, I haven't read a Spider-Man book that didn't backtrack anything, just kept moving forward, took what people did, and never talked down to me as a person. If anything, I found out stuff about myself through that book, and even when there was controversy around your book, I always enjoyed it. Is there any chance that, I know what the current status of the books are, but is there any chance you might do a one-shot, something similar, at least, maybe not with the current continuity, but just something with Spider-Man, like, any point?
Not at this juncture. Maybe some years down the road. It's like when you're in a relationship and it's really intense, and you're together for a long time, and you don't want to see the person for, like, 20 years. So, you know, at some point down the road, I'm sure we'll have that conversation, but for right now, I'm seeing other people. So, yeah. Yes, sir.
Speaking of moving on to other things, my question to you is, which one of the failed B5 sequels was the hardest to let go of? Crusade or Legend of the Rangers, or are you really seeing other people? Or do you still feel something about these great things that didn't come through?
Well, I still feel very strongly about Crusade in particular, because that was an infant strangled in its crib.
Yeah.
I mean, it never had a chance to hit air before they decided they didn't want to do science fiction in general at all. That was what caused the decision to get made. Yeah. It was nothing to do with us. Because we had a good cast, good bunch of characters. So, I mean, I like playing in science fiction. The show I'm developing currently for Imagine is mainstream, but I love science fiction. And the funny thing is, prior to the last few years, Warner Brothers couldn't be bothered about Babylon 5 as far as a feature or other stuff is concerned. Now, suddenly, since Changeling, and I'm working with Ron Howard and Spielberg. and other people. suddenly their antennas have gone up, you know, and they're saying, you know, how much would it take to do the B5 feature properly? Are there any TV things in the B5 universe you want to talk about? And now I'm doing the waiting game.
Yeah. Yes.
Well, you know, let me think about it for a while. Yeah. Welcome back to you.
Thank you.
First, congrats on Changeling. I saw a little while ago, blew my mind. Have you ever thought of doing like a historical fiction or crime drama in a different genre?
The script that I can't talk about is a historical mystery kind of a thing. And I like playing in that area. Having been a journalist in the past, I like digging into stuff. There's also a spec I have recently that I finished up that I gave to a director to look at, which is also a historical mystery kind of a thing. So, yeah, I love true stories. I think that nothing you can make up can ever be as weird as what we can do on our own. In fact, in B5, the person mentioned earlier, there's a story that Londo, I think, tells about a Centauri guard who was sent out, you know, always standing in the same place year after year, because 200 years earlier, the princess had looked out, saw the first spring rose coming through, and positioned a guard to stand over it to protect it, and never rescinded the order, so they always had a guy standing there every year without fail. Well, that's based on a Russian story of one of the Tsarinas who made that request of a guard and was there for like 100 years. Not the same guy. Progressive generations. Although standing over a flower could enhance your life, I don't know. I haven't tried it myself, but so that kind of stuff. Whenever I wanted to get alien, I looked at us. That's the best way to do it. Yes, sir.
Interesting about the Tsars. You know, the last Tsarina of Russia ended up moving to Toronto.
I didn't know that.
Where she died. She's buried in the cemetery. She's down the way.
She came here and she died.
Well, not.
Because that would be a really awful thing to happen.
It'd be kind of ironic.
Get off the boat, go down.
I made it.
Precisely.
Hello, Mr. Strzynski. Pardon me, Strzynski.
Please, for all y'all, Joe is fine.
Hello, Joe.
Even I can't see Mr. Strzynski blowing out an incisor.
Okay. First, I just wanted to say that I consider you a personal inspiration and have tried to model some of my own writing based on the things I've learned from you.
I'm so sorry.
And I did have two small questions, if you don't mind. The first one, does music influence you in any way when you are writing, and what kinds?
I have music going on most of the time while I'm writing. And by the way, if there are any writing-related questions, if there are any, you know, incipient or latent writers, and better latent than never, I always say, feel free to ask questions in that regard. I have music on because it helps to create the mood for it. Although I have a very, very broad iPod. Everything from Mozart to Marilyn Manson to Rob Zombie to, you know, Benny Goodman. So it's always changing on me. But the strangest things will happen when you have music on and you're writing, because there's synchronicity that happens. I was working on Comes the Inquisitor. I wanted to have the conversation between him and Sheridan and the Inquisitor when he's coming at them. And as I'm thinking, how should I structure this? And there's an Alice Cooper song that came on from Last Temptation. And it says, you know, what about Christ? What about war? What about this? What about that? Shit. I'm going to steal that.
Thank you, because the same thing happens to me. So that's reassuring.
The same song, I would think.
No. The one that just got me was Get It On by T-Rex. Get It On, Bang A Gong, that one.
I don't want to know what you're writing.
No. It's an action sequence.
Action great sequence. Country.
Action sequence, okay. I'm not getting out of this hole, am I? Okay. Second question deals with the episode Signs Important. Signs Importance.
And it's just a Hortense.
Yeah. And the eye that Londo wants back, and the what's his name? Raider. The Raider that's number 6. He brought the eye on board his ship. And suddenly the alarms go off, and a shadow vessel comes out of hyperspace and blows the crap out of that ship.
This is a William Shatner moment, isn't it?
And somehow, Morgan shows up with the eye. Now, I just sort of assumed that a shadow had snuck on board the ship and took the eye and went off. But what's the official, like, how did they get it off the ship? Like, why wasn't the eye destroyed?
Well, when I wrote the episode, the script, it says it disables the ship. And the CGO kind of had a blowing up. So I just assumed they found it amongst the debris at that point.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm so sorry, everyone. He came on his own. I couldn't. Yes. Hello.
Hey. Hello, Joe. Hi. I'm just wondering, what would you have done, or what would you like to have done if you got a chance of continuing with Captain Power, or you got a chance to do a reboot of Captain Power? Like, I know it's a, I know it was about 40 years ago, but it's one of those little shows I wrote that's it's got a special place in my heart, you know. Maybe not so much in yours, I guess.
He's Russian, but I don't know. See, I left the show because they're giving the toy company more power than I thought they should have. Larry Dottoli and I worked out a whole arc for the following year, which would follow.
I read a bit about it. I read it.
So why are you asking me for?
No, I just want to know like, what you would have done. Like, what else?
What you read?
Something about those archers and.
Yes.
You know, that's what I'm asking. If you got into chess to do a reboot, what would you like?
A reboot?
Yeah.
They did, it was called Terminator. which Captain Power stole from blatantly. I wouldn't go back to it. At gunpoint, I wouldn't go back to it. I'm sorry, that isn't a very good answer. I can tell you a joke in lieu of a good answer. Why is it better that Christ was crucified instead of stoned to death? It's easier to do this than this.
just one more question. What influence has Tolkien had in your work?
I'm sorry,
Tolkien?
Yes,
yeah,
Tolkien.
You always see like references like a you know a villain named Zoran, the shadows from Zahadun, like you know.
In the form of a question,
what influence has Tolkien had on you? Like, because you do see a little bit here.
I have a history of reading Lord of the Rings trilogy every year since I was in college. Because you always pick up more stuff. I mean, look, I taught myself how to read and write Elvish when I was in college. How much of a geek am I? and love the work of Elvish Presley. And it's not a direct influence. As a writer, you pick up influences and stories and material like a sweater creates Lynch, you know? And you get a little bit of Rod Serling in there, you get a little Tolkien, you get Isaac Asimov, Ray Bradbury, Harlan Ellison, and one day you do this, and oh, there's a short story there, or there's a series there. So it's an influence, but I wouldn't say it was going into B5 that much of an influence. I like some of the language that he created, so I borrowed some of the elements of that, but that's about as far as it went. Thank you.
Christopher Lee reads it once a year, too.
I'm sorry?
Christopher Lee?
Yeah.
Who played.
Oh yeah. So yeah,
he reads it once a year too.
Yeah, I heard that.
You guys should get together.
I really enjoyed Midnight Nations and Rising Stars, and I was wondering if you ever planned on doing anything else with that, possibly turning it into a movie or a series or anything like that.
There is a producer who has come to me recently. I've held off. I control the rights for Midnight Nations, and I've had a lot of folks come to me over the years and say, why not do it? And I've held back the rights because I didn't think that they were the right guys to do it. But recently someone has come to myself, my producing partner, Sam Barnes, to say, you know, we want to do this and we want you to direct it. And so that's something that is possibly in the wings. So Rising Stars, we will have to see. Heroes caused a lot of problems for me because I took out Rising Stars after Heroes and they said, this is like Heroes, but we came first. Yeah. That doesn't matter.
I actually work in the film and television industry, and there was a show we were trying to get off the ground that got canned because Heroes turned bad. And they're like, well, no, Heroes is going down now. No one likes it, so we're not willing to listen to you and what you want to do on your show.
What are you doing to film and television?
I'm currently going to the Canadian Film Center in the producing lab.
Ah, okay.
And, but prior to that, I was a production coordinator on some of the pilots and stuff.
Okay. Yeah, that's something I've done recently. I formed my own production company, Imaginary Voices Entertainment, which is a division of and the horse you rode in on productions. When I told the name of the company to my friend Larry Wachowski, he said, Joe, you gotta let go of the rage. And my partner in that company is back there, it's Sam Barnes, also a comic book writer, sitting there with a black shirt, and her mom, Bridget, next to her.
Where is that based out of?
Pardon?
Is that based out of LA?
LA.
Huh?
Yeah.
Do you have a resume?
Thank you. 4,000 miles. Yes.
I had a couple of questions about Changeling, and I came in here a little bit late, so if you covered this already, my apologies.
We had a whole long discussion of when you were gone. He went from frame one to the last frame, fade in to fade out, get the alternate ending, which they all know, but you don't. But for money, they can be convinced to give it to you. So we probably covered it, but go ahead.
Okay, is there a bad day? What do you
mean? I'm there for you.
Yeah.
That's okay, the scary part.
I'm just a little curious what your experience, sorry, I had a couple of questions. What is your experience like working with Clint Eastwood on, first of all? And second of all, since it's such a 1E from projects like Babylon 5 and all the sequels to that, did you find yourself being pigeonholed between projects?
As far as working with Clint Eastwood is concerned, Clint, it's so funny. He is actually shy in his way, which is the funny thing about it. The first time I met with him, we were sitting on a couch like this, and I'm looking at him. He's looking this way, having the conversation. Very quiet, soft voice. And you almost forget who you're talking to after a while. Then he turns, and those eyes hit you. Oh shit, it's Clint Eastwood. And you remember what your colon is there for. But sadly, the Writers Guild strike hit shortly into filming. So I was only there for a very brief window to see how he worked. It was like taking a master's class in directing to watch him work. And he keeps a very quiet set. He doesn't say action or cut. He'll say, go ahead or start. And I asked him, why? He said, well, it comes from working in Westerns. Because the director would learn that if you yell action, the horse would go, throw the actor off into the woods. So they'd say very quietly, go ahead. And I said, I say that now to not make the actors bolt and go into the woods. You know? And it makes it more of a moment that way, which is kind of interesting. But a truly a nice guy. He showed up the first day of shooting with a big old white cockatoo on his arm. And I went up to him and I said, what's the bird's name? He said, it's a big white bird, what would you call it? I don't know. He said, Larry. Larry Bird. See? Took you a minute too, didn't it? Why Larry? Oh, really? And being pigeonholed, I was pigeonholed in television because I came into features through the auspices of a historical drama and Clint, who was mainstream, and Angelina, who was mainstream. Suddenly that redeemed that whole situation for me. So now what I'm trying to do is to take on one mainstream project for every two genre things that I do. And so I keep one foot in both worlds. And I puzzle them because I do comics, I do television, I do movies, it's the Prince of Medicine Land formula that I try and use, where they can't pin me down. So I've been very fortunate in the film world not to be typecast.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Hi, Joe. First off, I just want to say that I heard once that you write every day, and yeah. I've tried to do that. It's a good inspiration for how to work, even if I haven't always done it. But I have a question, and it's another nerd question, so. There's nothing I hate more
than... It's okay, you're among friends. Actually, this is an intervention. We all planned this for your behalf. The drugs have got to stop. We're worried about you. Your mom and I are very concerned.
She's happy to hear that.
Am I right?
Yes.
He's seeing girls now?
Sure, yes.
Yeah.
Yes, he is.
And so
the intervention
legs.
Has worked.
The intervention has worked?
Yes.
He's
yes.
Healed. You're healed.
Maybe another one.
Another one?
Yeah.
All right. We're getting you laid, don't worry about it.
The point is, there's nothing I hate more than a story that doesn't have an ending yet. And I'm not going to ask you to outline the next 5 years of Crusade or anything, because I loved that thing, but I also loved Supreme Power, and it ended at the middle of a fight in a cliffhanger, and if you had it thought out, could you tell me how fake Superman was going to beat up? I don't remember that guy's name. And keep him from detonating nuclear bombs, or, well, you remember it.
In that place with those guys and that stuff?
Can I tell you how it would end it?
Yes.
No. I mean, I know, but A, it would take 20 minutes,
oh,
and there's a lot of line behind you, and B, I'd plan to steal that for something else.
Okay. Can you at least put it out there that that's the ending so I can know?
I'll send you a note. I'll call your mom, as all of us do these days.
Somehow write in a giant white bird, and we'll know.
Yes. Yeah, and no, I do write every day. I try to write about 10 hours a day, if I can. And except for my birthday, New Year's Day, and Christmas Day. It's just part of the discipline. You have to get used to doing it every day until it becomes second nature. Yes, ma'am. Our first woman question. Not coming there.
I actually haven't read any questions, so that was a great segue.
Oh, good, thank you.
With Babylon 5, you set it up for a 5-year arc. I was just wondering if you could speak of any problems you had with keeping that 5-year arc in place, if people had, like, if the networks had any notes and you were, like, wanting to change things, if the dynamics of it were problematic. Because you wrote most of Babylon 5. So I was wondering if that was an issue for you, if there was kind of a... Yeah.
The main problem with the 5-year arc with Warner Brothers was them saying, you'd be lucky if you get 2 years. You know, why are you messing around with a 5-year arc? But I said, we're on a mission from God, mofo. Yeah. We're trying to kill our 5 years.
Can I put that on my blog?
Please. Because if you think about it, prior to B5, no American space-based science fiction series other than Star Trek had gone more than 3 seasons in 20 years. So the odds were very much against it. So they just didn't believe it was going to happen. After that, you know, they said, if you want to take a shot at it, you know, roll the dice. And I said, they were rolled 5 years ago. The only other hard part was sometimes the actors would be confronted with a script that referenced things that were going to happen 2 years down the road, and they would kind of go, eh, you know, and I'd have to explain to them as much as I could what that meant, because you didn't want to explain too much. Otherwise, the actor begins to play the result and not the process. So if Londo in the first year knew that he and Jakar were going to be best buddies by year 5, he might play it more sympathetically. But I didn't want that. So I said, you and he are arch enemies and always will be, knowing full well what was coming down the road. So you lie. That's what producers do. Thank you.
Hi, Joe. Welcome to Toronto.
Thank you.
I've been a fan. I'd like to say I was a fan since B5, but apparently I was a fan since He-Man.
What did I ever do to you?
Wow.
I just had 2 quick questions, if I may.
No. You were doing fine, and all of a sudden you broke through He-Man app, and I'm crushed.
How about the Ghostbusters? Was that?
That was after Ghostbusters. What's your questions?
The first one is, now that you're doing all this mainstream film work with people like Clint Eastwood and Ron Howard and other people, do you think you have more to add to update your screenwriting guide?
I would have to start from scratch. I've learned so much more in the last 10 years than I knew when I wrote that book, on how to write scripts, that I couldn't update it. I'd have to just burn it and start fresh. But that's for those of you who are writers. That's the process. You learn and you add tools to your toolbox. When you start off, you got maybe a pair of rusty pliers and a screwdriver, you know, and you can only make a few limited number of things from that. But over the years, you watch other writers, you learn things, and you begin to acquire more and more tools. And so the tools I have now are in a really large box. The tools I had when I wrote the screenwriting book, are, you know, like that. So no, I would have to completely just start all over again.
Thank you. And secondly, you're attached with the World War Z film project. Can you talk to me about that?
Yeah, I wrote adapted World War Z, the Max Brooks book, for Paramount. And they're very excited about it. We have a director, Mark Forster, attached to it, who did the last James Bond film. And the Paramount wants to make it. They want to make it badly. Well, they want to make it a lot. They want to make it badly. That wouldn't be good at all. We'll see where that goes. I know that if Forbidden Planet comes out as everyone expects it to come out, script-wise, we hope to shoot that in 2010 and have it out in 2011. And there's something else I'm forgetting, I can't recall what the hell it is, but there's other, I've written 10 screenplays in the last 2 years. And most of them are heading for production, which is the most bizarre thing. The Ninja Assassin situation, and so this is why writing 10 hours a day comes in handy. Again, the Wachowskis are friends of mine. And they called me one day on a Monday to say, we have a script for this movie we're gonna shoot, go to camera in 6 weeks. We have a problem, can you come in and see us? And I came in to see them, and it wasn't so that the script wasn't right, it wasn't what they wanted to shoot. And I said, we want a full rewrite, from fade in to fade out. Can you give it to us? And I said, sure, when do you have to have it? I said, well, it has to go out to actors' agents on Friday. I met with them on Tuesday. So I wrote the full draft in 53 hours, end to end. 2 hours sleep a night for 3 days. And gave it to Warner's, and they had no notes, which scared the hell out of me, because that's not like them. And we shot it, and it's actually pretty good. You know, something written in 53 hours is pretty good, which means it's in focus. But no, I'm actually very happy with that. Bloody as hell.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
My question is writing, because obviously you write in like a bunch of mediums, you write novels and movies and comics and everything else like that, and you've also sort of done both sides of original characters versus well-established characters, and I know you pretty much held on pretty tightly to Bat Five, like writing the outlines for the novels and everything. My question is more along the lines of A, which you do you prefer, and B, which way is it easier to get into the writing field? Is it like grabbing established characters or just always writing your own stuff?
It depends on what you're after. So that's kind of a broad question. A job. Oh, you're so screwed. In television, you want to start out writing for TV shows that are already extant. So you write shows based on shows that are on the air currently as spec scripts to send out to get work. Or you can write an original work of fiction, work of a screenplay as a sample of your work to show how you can create stuff on your own. There's no good answer to that. Comics, it's easier to get into, obviously, like Marvel or DC by showing something you've done somewhere else on an independent basis, and then you walk in and say, this is what I want to do for your character. Because, and here's the key to this, on any show or any comic book that's been around for a long time, A, they're almost out of ideas. B, there are supporting characters who need to be serviced. And if you can find a way in to say, here's this character who, you know, the fans like, but has never had a story around their stuff, and we want to do a miniseries about that character, you might sell that. And always again, bear in mind that they've done everything under the sun after a while, and sometimes a fresh voice is really helpful to that. When I was brought in to pitch on Jake and the Fat Man, I really didn't want to pitch on Jake and the Fat Man, because, well, it was Jake and the Fat Man. My TV guy log line on Jake and the Fat Man is, he can't walk, he can't act, together they fight crime. I didn't want to do it. My agent kept saying, you gotta go in. So I went in to see them. I had three areas that I worked out and one small, like a two-liner. And the three areas I pitched at them, they had already done. And I'm thinking, I'm almost out of this. They said, do you have anything else? Said, well, one small thing. And what I thought of was, William Conrad was a large guy. And large guys don't like to walk around a lot, like sitting in one chair and having lots of dessert. And so I said, what if in an episode he's kidnapped and tied to a chair for the whole episode? And he said, that's great, you won't have to walk around that way. He hates that. So I sold the script. And I turned it in on at noon Monday, and they called to hire me at 4 o'clock. You know, so it's a question of just looking at things through fresh eyes. So the long and short of it is, I have no good answer to your question.
Thank you. And just a really quick question. One of my favorite things you've ever done is actually Dream Police. And it was like super like nipping the surface to me, and I don't know if there's any chance of that coming out in any way bigger form or expanded.
One of the biggest producers in town wants to do Dream Police as a movie, a big movie. So we'll see where that goes.
That'd be awesome.
Thank you.
Hi, Joe.
Hi.
I'm wondering,
why is this except for one woman, all guys? What the hell is going on here? Ladies, come on. Show some spine. Don't be, there you go. Oh, she's leaving. Feel free. Don't be frightened. Yes.
Wondering, with the advent of TV on DVD almost seeming economically viable, if the way writing is going for DVD or for TV seems to be changing, like, if you were to go back and make Babylon 5 when it wouldn't be completely tied up with DS9 at the same time, whether you would make it differently, whether you do less intros and endings, and whether you basically, whether knowing it's going to DVD in a year or in 6 months would change the way you write it at all.
I don't think so. Because you still have the five-act structure, because you have the commercial breaks. But if you're writing two DVD without commercial breaks, then it's a different kind of writing. Because otherwise what you have to do is the first three or four pages you're catching up in the last act, and the next three or four you're setting up the next act, and you have the commercial break. So you're always doing this, you know. Whereas if you're writing it straight through, you're kind of doing this. You know? So if you know you're only writing for DVD, then yes. But if you write for DVD by way of television, then the answer is there's no difference.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Hello, Joe. Thank you very much for the Babylon 5 script books. So I was wondering, there were two pieces of advice that you gave in the script books. One was never surrender your dreams and stick with what you believe in. And I was wondering, do you have sort of a personal anecdote or a professional anecdote about where that was inspired by?
Well, it comes from two areas, really. One is just in general my life, because growing up, like most of you who have ambitions or dreams to be more than, you know, working in a cubicle the rest of your life for a faceless master in a distant mountaintop, those around you will often say, don't do it because you're going to fail, it's not going to happen. I come from nowhere and nothing. I'm a street kid from Jersey, you know, who everyone said, you aren't Rod Serling, you're not going to be that person, so don't set yourself a failure. And I just decided early on, screw all of you, I'm going to do this, and I'm not going to give up my dreams. And so that was part of it. And as far as the rest of it goes, this is kind of a long story, so bear with me. When I was in high school, my senior year, since you had a passport specific incident, we had career day, which is they take from all the local high schools the best actors, the best athletes, the best dancers, the best hookers, you know, whatever it happens to be, and writers, we're kind of in the same boat. And they bring them to this one college campus, Southwestern College in San Diego, to show off their stuff. And they put the writers as far away from human company as possible, you know, way off in his room by itself, and a bunch of like 10 of us on these long tables and lawn chairs. And no one was coming in. I was just like dead. And finally I look up, and there's a guy who comes in, salt and pepper hair, corduroy jacket, looks familiar but I can't place him offhand, very tan, very lined. And he begins going down the tables and comes to where I'm sitting and picks up one of my short stories and goes off and sits in a lawn chair, reads it, it's pretty short, comes back, gets a second one, reads it, and stops in front of me and looks down and says, verbatim, you have a great and abiding talent for someone of your age. Two pieces of advice. First, cut every third adjective, which I'm still working on, by the way. Second, never let them stop you from telling the story you want to tell. And leaves. And the advisor comes over on rocket sleds. What did he say? And I told her what he said. And he said, don't you know who that was? So we look kind of familiar. It's Rod Serling. He's here to talk at the college tonight in about an hour. He must have gotten here early and was walking around. I'm out the door. And he's gone, like an apparition, just gone, disappeared. And that was the first validation that I had. And the notion of tell your own story, never let them stop you from telling your story. Funny thing is, years later, I'm working on the new Twilight Zone. And they come in with an outline that Rod had written, never put in the script form, to say, would you like to collaborate posthumously? Yeah. And as the production guy from television knows, Outlines are written for the studio and for the network, and that's about it. They aren't meant to be read outside. Nonetheless, in this outline, every line was a polished gem. Every line made you just knock back in your chair. He's describing a room where an old woman is dying. Quote, panel walls polished by darkness. Fuck me. I could sit there for a year and not come up with that. And so I wrote it, and I got my favorite thing of all time. I have a letter from Carol Serling to say she thought it was as if Rod had written it, style-wise. That, of all the things that I've got, the accolades, the awards, that's number one. And funny is, after, this is a long story, I apologize. After I finished up on Zone, I have a tendency to want to pick up like a trophy for whatever I work on to say this is what it was. And I went to an Art Deco store called Piccolo Pete's in the Valley in LA and bought this Art Deco watch, a Hamilton Ventura. They just came out with a new version of it. It hadn't been available since the 50s and 60s when it was the first electric watch. So he's packaging it up, we're talking, giving the credit card. And he says, what do you do? I said, well, I'm a writer. And he said, really? The last one I had of these back in the 60s, I sold to a writer. I said, really, who was that? He said, Rod Serling. Now I'm really going to screw with you. 2 years ago, I'm on eBay. I have an eBay habit. I'm sorry. I spent a lot of money on eBay. And I saw a book autographed by Rod Serling and signed to someone. But wouldn't it be funny if it was signed to Joe? So I click on it. Guess what? It was signed to Joe, who was the cook at the college where he used to teach at. And he had a little provenance to go with it to prove that this was an authentic signature and why he signed it. It's on my shelf now. So that's where it comes from.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hey, I'm a big fan. I've been reading the news groups from way back when on Babylon 5, and the post that you kind of update on what you're working on and stuff. And at one point there was some stuff about a sort of secretive sci-fi project that you're working on. But then it looked like maybe it went south or something like that. But is there anything more you could talk about that, or if you know if the project is still going on with other people, or if it's dead? Or
what it was, the Wachowskis and I got together to say, let's write something for television. And we wrote the first 3 hours of a new series. And we took it out, and it's so scared. The networks all wanted it because it was us, but they read it, and it was so unusual and so revolutionary and so off the beaten track, and they just scared the hell out of them. So that's what that was. And I still think that's some of the best work that they and we have done independently and together. But at some point, we want to go back and revive the pop, maybe as a feature film or something. But it was quite extraordinary. And they're good guys to work with. They're very nice guys.
Yeah, keep posting. Thanks.
Thank you.
First, I want to say hockey must have heard you because they got rid of ties now. So I think
did they?
We're finally a sport.
Finally a sport. Yeah, you.
I do have a question though. Of all the aliens you've created for Babylon 5, which would you say is your baby? Like, which one are you the most proud of? That you think is the most original?
Races or individuals?
Races, specific alien races.
Races, I would have to say probably the Minbari, but on an individual basis, I would say Jakar, because he's the one guy who I aspire to be but can never be. And if I identify with the character, it'd probably be Londo. Sad to say. Not with the six, not that stuff. Just although when I wrote that script, where we have them gambling, we learn Londo has six appendages. Yes. My story editor, Larry Tillich, came bursting into my office when the script went out and said, let me get this straight. You tell me that I can't do camp. You've got a guy cheating cards with his dick. I said, write what you know. He never brought it up again. I'm doing this, it's because my ears is closed down because I'm still working off the cough. Yes, hi.
Hi, Joe. How's it going?
Oh, great. It's been wonderful. How's your day been?
Not too
bad. Yeah? Sleep in today? Did you get up early?
It's Conde. I had to get up early.
Oh, I see. You are you in school?
No. Okay. Not anymore.
Okay.
Quick question. I'm.
Drop out. Your parents will think you're in school then. Okay, got it.
All right. When you're building a universe like the V5 universe, how much of it changes as it grows? Because in my writing, I kind of go down a path, and then as I do something or experience something, they're like, "Oh, this is a good idea. I should. My character should encounter this." Or, you know, it just kind of keeps changing, and I can't pin an idea. I really can't narrow down to building this universe that the character lives in because everything keeps growing. Like we know the V5 story was kind of laid out in the recipe cards. Did you feel times where you're like, I can take that out, put something else in, or when you started doing it, like this is how it's going to be, this is how it's going to be done?
You take the outline as your rope, your safety valve. That allows you to wander off and try something. If it doesn't work out, you can zoom back and grab the safety line again. So in the course of making the show, things did morph and change over time, but not radically. It was always within terms of the character, because you learn things as you write that you only experience by being with that character. As Mark Twain once said, a man who picks up a cat by the tail learns things he can learn no other way. And working in a TV show is a lot like that. You work with the actors, you learn what their skills are, what their range is, you can start feeding them more stuff, and you realize you can do more with them. And this is just the process of organically finding a character, where the character starts talking to you in their own terms. Example a friend tends to give is, he was writing a script about this older woman, who very fastidious, very neat, and she's upstairs, and he wants to kill her off, and she walks to the stairs, she trips over a fold in the carpet, goes down, dead. Then he said, then she got up, dusted herself off, said, look, asshole, it doesn't work like that. I'm very neat, I'm very clean, fastidious, there wouldn't be a lump in the carpet. What you want to do instead is walk toward the staircase. I think that I closed the door that properly should. Look back, and when I look back, I tripped down the stairs. All right. She backs her up, you know, does the whole thing, at least now she stays dead this time. You know. It's really a question of getting to know the characters. Here's the secret to writing. It's simple as, I've said this everywhere, so if you heard it before, my apologies. Imagine your best friend for a second. If you haven't got one, borrow the best friend of the person next to you in the aisle. And imagine your friend walking across the living room at night with lights off, and they bang their shin on the coffee table. Now you know your friend. You know exactly what your friend's going to say when that happens. You don't have to think about it or worry about it. It's just there. That's what writing is. You get to know the character so well that whatever you drop them into, you sit back and write down what they do. It's that simple.
Sounds easy anyway.
If done right, it can be.
Okay, thank
is,
you.
This, is this a 1 hour and 90 minute? Who knows?
90 minutes.
Is it?
Hey, again.
Hi.
Okay. So, glutton for punishment, really. My two questions again. One is, how old were you when your first piece of writing became recognized in a way that somebody wanted to pay you for it?
I was 17.
Really? Wow. Okay. Behind the time.
I have 90 minutes, I can talk about whatever I want. I always knew I was going to be a writer, but I held off writing for a long time because I wasn't ready yet. And when I hit 17, I remember I was home finishing up a Lovecraft short story from the anthology, The Color Out of Space. Mm. I put it down, and I could feel a key turn in my head, like a jet engine coming on. And I said, no, I'm ready. And at that day onward, I began writing nonstop. And the first thing I wrote was a couple of short stories and an article which I sold to Senior Scholastic when I was like 17. And I had my first play produced when I was 18. And they ran it in summer stock over the course of the summer. And I just began selling nonstop from newspapers. And by the way, those of you who are aspiring writers, there's nothing as reaffirming as seeing your name in print from anything. So if you're working on comics or short stories or movies, whatever it is, take a moment to talk to your college paper or your local paper or your local magazine and maybe sell an article or two. First off, it's money, and money never hurts. Second, it's a credit, which gives you some legitimacy. And third, that it just reaffirms to your family, say, look, I published this. You know, I this is real. And they can look at it and hold it in their hands and see that, yeah, you do have some talent. So that's where I started off, was basically writing short stories and articles. So I was working for papers and magazines by the time I was in my late teens, and went on to work for the LA Times when I was in my 20s, and San Diego Magazine, and a bunch of others. So I started very early. What's your other question?
Okay. Second question would be, I guess the best way I can phrase this, if you do not have some form of certificate or, you know, a screen rating certificate or a diploma or something, and you want to pitch a script to someone, is that the end of the world, or are they going to say, well, this person is just an amateur, I'm not even going to read it?
No one has ever asked me what school I went to, what I majored in, what my degrees were, none of that. What matters is the quality of your storytelling. When I sold Changing and I got all these meetings with networks and studios afterward, none of them knew that I worked in television before. They didn't know, they didn't care. They didn't care how old I was. They didn't care if I was 20 or 90. They saw the words on the page. That's all that mattered to them. No, in my experience, honest to God, it doesn't make a difference if you have a degree or not. It's what you do with it. My degrees are in clinical psychology and sociology, you know, which doesn't qualify me to do anything but be unemployed. And I actually had entered the master's program at San Diego State because my parents wanted me to. I didn't want to be there. But it's like the guilt thing, you know. So I thought, how do I get out of this? Well, I'll fake my graduation. So I said to my parents, I worked out a deal. I have all these credits from here. I get my master's degree in 1 year. Really? Said they. No problem. So I had a friend of mine, I worked for the college paper, so I had new guys in the admissions office get my name into the rolls for the graduating class. And I rented the cap and gown. And I had a guy in the art department, I knew working in the theater department, make me a diploma. So day of the graduation, I'm there, my cap and gown, you know, everybody else, I'm lined up, you know, and the whole thing. My parents see me, got pictures and the whole bit, diploma. And they didn't know for years. Years! My dad keeps looking at the phone like, is that coming off? No, it's just it's cheap ink they use, the printing process, you know. And it was like 5 years down the road that after I was making a living as a writer, which that's what I wanted to do, to get out and be a full-time writer, that I finally copped to the fact that this was all a setup. So no, it doesn't matter where you've gone, it's what you can do with words. It's all that matters.
So, just to be clear then, your advice is...
cheat and lie.
I was going to say, see, I have lots and lots of things that I've written, and I've never pitched any of them because I always believe that no one would want to read them. So your advice is to try anyway. I'm not saying I'm good, I don't know, but you know what I'm saying?
Every writer has to do that. Every writer has to be convinced that they have something worth saying. And every writer that I know starts not having sold something. We all begin from a blank page. We all begin with no credits. We all begin with no name. But you put it out there, you write, you finish what you're writing, you put it on the market, keep it on the market until sold. That's the rule.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hey, Joe. So I have two quick questions. Is Babylon 5 ever going to come to Blu-ray? I think that would be good. And then
I don't know. I imagine someday it will.
I'm waiting for a giant box set in Blu-ray.
So am I.
Okay. And I also just want to say I really appreciated all of your really strong female characters on Babylon 5 and like Delenn. It was great because like even when they were married, she said, you know, like he would try to protect her and she'd go, you gotta remember who I am, right? So did you ever get any pushback from the studio or was it like easy sailing? You could just do whatever you wanted with them?
They were fine with it. After episode two of year two, I never got those from Warner Brothers. So they were fine with it, and the actresses loved it because they weren't being defined as one role over another. They could go beyond that. And I've always been really good at writing female characters, which is why when I did Changeling, there was like a bloodbath in Hollywood of actresses who wanted to fight for that role. I'm not quite sure why I like women. I like writing women as much as I do. I love them. And, but glitch in my head that makes me see female characters as not just, you know, a mom or a secretary or this, that they're well-rounded people, because they are in real life, you know? Thank you. And why it takes guys so long to figure that out in the writing business, I don't understand, you know? And like, there's this really interesting, cool guy with all these great quirks, and he hates spiders and this, and his girlfriend. There's more going on, if you choose to see it there. But then in real life, I like strong women around me. I like someone who can challenge me and beat me, not in lecture. In lecture. You're a tough bunch. Who can challenge me intellectually and can outsmart me. I love being outsmarted, because it doesn't happen very often. So that's the way I guess you write what you like.
Great, thanks.
Thank you.
Hi, Joe.
Kyle.
I've got two unrelated questions. First of all, what can you tell us about the two owner-created comics that you keep teasing about but never talking about?
I'm doing two creator-owned titles for Image. And I can't talk about them because the concepts are really, really cool. And the moment I say it, if I don't get it out there fast, someone's going to eat my lunch.
So when are they coming out?
The problem is I've got so much stuff going on right now, which is why I'm trying to dial back some of the comics work to make room for other comics work, and be some for the movie work as well. So I do want to address that this year and get those books out. Because Eric Stevenson, who's the publisher of Image, has been very patient with me. And that's been 2 years of dragging my ass on this. What's your other question?
The second one is just off the top, just wondering, with all of the new technology, with cell phones and everything, have you ever had any issues with writing stories that technology spoils? Like, for instance, you used to be able to get all sorts of tension going because somebody couldn't find a telephone. Well, that's never going to happen.
No, but actually it works out to your benefit because, as we all saw in X-Files, which lived and died by the cell phone, writing a piece of fiction or script that takes place in the 1800s is a pain in the ass, because you have to ride somewhere to give someone information, then ride back again with the other information. Now you just pick up a phone and you call it. So it helps exposition and complications and plot enormously to have technology. So it really has never been an obstacle in that respect as far as making plots are concerned. It's kind of fun to look down the road a bit and see what technology is bringing us in the future. I think within 10 years we're going to have 3D TVs as we have HD TVs now, given what Pioneer is working on, which is pretty cool stuff. But I've never had a problem with it. Thank you.
Hi, Joe.
Howdy.
Big fan. And
well, you're an average size fan.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Two very quick questions, both related to Babylon 5. Number one, would you say the door is now closed on B5? You've moved on, or will there be more in terms of DVD titles or Memory of Shadows, those sort of operations?
No more DVD titles. I haven't moved on, but I have said to Warner's that I won't do any more until it's a big budget feature film. And they're actually somewhat open to that now. So at this point, the last conversation I had with them was, they said to me, go off and think of something, and bring us back something you want to do, then we'll talk about making it happen. So that door is open on that side of it. I'm torn, and I'll be quite honest about it. On one level, I love that universe dearly. I would love to return to that universe. I also know that this is a town that can typecast you real quick and fast. And when I got the feature work going, I broke out of that. And part of me says, do you want to go back to that, or do you want to keep going where you are and give another year or two? So I'm going back and forth about that. I kind of have an idea for what the future would be. It needs to germinate for a while longer, because if we're going to do one, it has to be a really good one. It can't be a throwaway. And I haven't worked out quite what that story is yet. The short answer is, at some point down the road, we'll be, taking a shower or walking in the park, not that they ever walk in parks, but or shower in the parks. And like a toaster oven, there'll be a ding in the back of my head, which will happen the first time, and I'll have a story there. And when that story appears, I'll go to them and say, let's make this happen.
Okay, great. Actually, segueing off of Toasters there for a moment.
This is going to be really good.
This will be good. Actually, it will.
A Toaster segue, that's tough.
It is. Okay, so with shows like Battlestar Galactica, the Reimagined series and stuff like that, how do you perceive Babylon 5 as the origin for long story arc science fiction serials?
No. No? Not the origin. Particularly for, if you look at British television, I mean, Doctor Who and Blake Seven, you know, and Prisoner, long preceded us. In terms of American television, obviously you had serials that would run in the afternoons, early evenings, that would go on for years, long, ongoing stories, but they tended to make those up as they went. Okay. It wasn't like a prearranged arc to them. So in terms of creating a five-year arc, specifically designing it ahead of time to have foreshadowing and so on, yes, it might be considered the progenitor of that particular form, but I don't want to start having delusions about my own importance because that'd be silly.
Okay, great.
I have delusions of my own to deal with.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Joey, I wanted to ask, I recently was watching the Babylon 5 series again, and I saw the episode where the seer tells Londo that he's got three chances to save himself, and I was kind of wondering, did you see Londo as actually being saved the end of the series?
He is in an odd sort of way, because by giving in to the nightmare of taking on the Keeper at the end of the show, that was his first really big sacrifice that he had, well, not for a second, they really had to make. And at the end, it was sacrificing his own life. So I think that in the long run, yeah, he did redeem himself. If there is a Centauri heaven, he is there, and they're as astonished by this as he is. he was a fascinating character to write. I every so often I'll close my eyes at night and I'll hear him. You know, just chattering to me. My dear friend Joel. You know? Shut up, trying to sleep. But I like the notion that he redeemed it, that he came around from a complete asshole to almost a saintly guy toward the end, as did Jakar. But they took different roads to get there.
Hi, back again. I just wanted to ask you a question that relates to writing and acting. I'm an actor myself, and I've used some of the stuff that you've written in your books for monologues. I'm in an acting class currently, and I did a monologue from Supreme Power, I think Hyperion's talking about. Somebody commits an act, everybody says it's okay, forgive him, but he can't get over it. I did them all, and I was like, where the hell is that from? Like, where? And I was like, it's a comic book. They're like, oh, really? That's kind of cool. And I find that you write really honestly. And I know you've worked with actors, and you know, acting is about finding the truth of that moment, right? Not thinking about it ahead, you just do it. And I just wanted to know, working as a writer and then working with actors, how is it to write something? And of course, you're writing from your own, what you know, and then they come in and they bring their own interpretation. How is it for you? Is it a collaborative issue, or do you kind of sit back, watch them, and then direct them if needed, along with the director who obviously is doing their thing?
There's a two-stage process. The first is the writing itself. And you're right, you have to write with some measure of honesty. Where writers tend to fail, particularly new writers, is when they try and push the characters in ways that are false. Because the audience and the reader will recognize that. They realize that you're pushing this character over here. He wouldn't logically do that. So if you're going to write something of value, you really have to follow the truth line at all times, which goes back to the coffee table thing. You write that what that person would say honestly when they bang their shit on the coffee table. Your job as an actor is, as James Cagney once said, is to stand up straight, face the wind, and tell the truth. And when you get to the stage, the actor takes the text and finds the truth of what's there, then puts it through the filter of their own experience. And sometimes it goes off in a little bit different direction. The scene in the elevator with Jakar and Londo, when they're trapped in it, I had wrote that is quite serious. It's the same dialogue, but you know, him saying, no, I'd rather die and see you die than help you. And I'm walking through the back of the set one afternoon, they're about to shoot that scene, and I hear laughter from the corner. I'm like, what? This is a very serious scene. What are you laughing about? And I come around and I catch the last part of the scene with the two in the elevator and Char just laughing his brains out at this awful dilemma that Londo's in. And they call cut and the actors look over and they see me and they get like the kids like, oh, we were just playing. we didn't mean nothing. We'll do it your way. You know? And I said, no, it's great. It's perfect. You know, because the truth of the character said that for Jakar, to see Londo die in front of him and not have to lift a finger to do that, just sit back and watch the elevator burn with both of them in it, would be hysterically funny. And that would never have occurred to me. But that truth of the actor brought it in. I brought the narrative truth of I won't help you. He brought the character truth of this is hysterical. So it's all about truth. Writing is about truth at its core. And the more honest you are in your writing, the more sincere you are, and the more you reveal of yourself, the better the work is going to be. The more you hide behind the words, the more false the word is going to be. The worse it's going to be. Yes, sir.
Hey, Joe.
Howdy.
I have a question. Well, actually, two questions. One is a writing-based question. One is a geek question. So I'll go with a writing-based question first. And that is, how do you get through the dark places when you're creating a script, you're going through all the ideas, you have everything planned out, and then you hit a block. You hit something that just doesn't make sense, but you need to get through it. And what do?
You ask the next question. No, not you. I mean, you as the writer. That's a great way around it. Fuck you, I got you. No, as the writer, you have to ask the next logical question. I mean, look, it's a bad example. If you're doing a mystery and there's a body on the ground, the next thing is someone has to call the cops. What's the next thing that happens logically? The cops show up. What happens logically? They take evidence. You know, it's the next logical question along the way. And usually if you find what that question is, you'll find the moment. And what you also need to understand is that very often a problem in Act 3 is actually a problem in Act 2. And a problem in Act 2 is often a problem in Act 1. It's where you set it up that you begin to go off the truth line a bit. At first you don't notice it. It's like that, you know, easy slide. Yeah, this is pretty good. Oh, shit. Yeah. And you think the problem's here. Well, no, it's back over here. You step to the left. Yeah. So backtrack your work and see, did you walk off the truth line? And very often the block is your brain saying, you're making shit up now. Go back and fix it.
And now the geek question.
Okay.
Free will or determinism?
Chocolate or vanilla? Well, what the hell are you talking about?
Through the course of Babylon 5, there's a real strong theme of choose, damn it, and follow your passions and do these things. And if you made a choice that you're not comfortable with, you often say you don't have a choice. You know, there's always these things. Poor Kosh, you know, has to go through the whole history of the whole show until he finally, you know, dies in a big burst of light, knowing what's going to happen. Did he have any choice? Did anybody else have any choice? Is it deterministic? Is it free will?
You can know that there's going to be, say, a big World War II level conflict as the overall arc, but the individual actions are still free will. And I'm a big believer in free will, and particularly in choice. We tend to fall asleep in our own lives. I'm not sure how many in this room are doing what they thought they were going to be doing when they were in high school. That we all had larger dreams than we have aspired to. And after a while, we start thinking, I can't choose differently. I have friends who live on the East Coast of the US and hate it. Say it's cold, the work sucks, I hate my job, I hate my boss, I hate my life, I hate my house. Move! Get up, grab your bags, and go somewhere else. Go where it's warm, go with you. And well, my relatives are here, my dog is here, this, and this, you know. And they always have a reason not to do it. And I'm a big believer, and as I said back in San Diego and MIT, in the notion of failure. You have to be willing to accept the possibility of failing to do anything worthwhile. But your parents and your friends are all surrounding you to say, don't do this, you're going to hurt yourself. You disappoint yourself, you're going to fail. And that's a terrible thing. It's not a terrible thing, it's a wonderful thing because you tried. I'll come over with a body matcher. I think you do have to follow your passion. You do have to, life is not a rehearsal. You're there, you know. And if you don't do it now, when are you going to do it? So I try and tell everyone, find what you're passionate about and do it. Case in point, a friend of mine has been working at a job at city government in San Diego, hating it. And But she's in her 50s. You know, what can I do? I'm stuck here. I said, no, you're not. What are you passionate by? I said to her. Well, I like my cats, my pets. Okay, good, that's a start. I like photography. I'm okay at it. I can do better. So we'll put them together. You're passionate about animals, passionate about cameras. Go to pet photography. It's not a huge area, not a lot of competition there. Got a good eye too, actually. And just try it. Start taking photos of your friends, put up a website, get some people to endorse you. Well, now, guess what? She's working 3 days a week at her job, and 2 days a week, custom pet photography. By the end of the year, 3 to 4 days a week will be custom pet photography. And she is the happiest she has been in 20 years, because she's doing what she loves to do. If you sit down and say, this is what I really care about, this is what I love doing, the odds are, if you're any good at it at all, you can make a living at it. But you have to leave the box. And once you're out of the box, you know what you discover? There aren't a lot of other people out there competing with you. Because everyone lives inside the box. You know? So take a chance. Whether you want to be a comic writer, or an artist, or a screenplay artist, a writer, whatever it is, try! I mean, no one ever gets to 90 years old lying in bed dying thinking, I should take fewer chances in life. You know? You think, I should have done more. And if you were to die today, what catalog of missed opportunities would there be in your head? You know? It's a terrible way to go to your death. I regret nothing on a professional level. Personally, I'm a catalog of people, you know, forget it. But professionally, when I was a kid, I said someday I want to do Superman, I want to do Spider-Man, and Forbidden Planet, and Lensman. Wouldn't that be great, you know? Guess what I'm doing? Forbidden Planet, Lensman, Superman, Spider-Man. What are the odds? A kid from Newark, New Jersey would be doing this shit. But you have to decide. You have to want it. And so I believe absolutely in free choice and free will. And you can, it's never too late to become what you're going to be in the first place. You know? Ever. Thank you. Thank you.
Mentioned that your big one for writing discipline and you write many hours of a day, every day, except, as you said, holidays. Do you have characters or plots come into your mind at night and break up your sleep, or is it just by the book, by the schedule?
Oh no, it's you can't shut it off. I have a tape recorder by the bed, not a video recorder, which would be recording sounds of silence anyway. Tape recorder and notepad and the pen with a light bulb built into it, because invariably I'd be working on Forbidden Planet and stuff, like I said, and I'll get to the end of the scene, and I gotta go to bed now, I lie down, and oh shit, that's a good line. Click. Oh crap, it's another one. And I'll do this for an hour, you know, because it never stops. That's the joy of it, though. When you're in that moment, to be able to really have the passion of hearing those characters' voices, that's an endless amount of fun, you know. So yeah, it's all night long. But I tend to write 10 hours. I tend to work at night, from 8 o'clock at night till 3 in the morning. And then from, I sleep till 11, 12. I spent like several hours revising the day before, and then by 8 o'clock I'm ready to start writing the fresh stuff, and I keep on going. Thank you.
So we got to wrap her up here, but I just want to say on behalf of everyone here, thanks for coming.
Thank you.
Thanks for sharing. Thanks for all you guys.